This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm fascinated. I'm so excited to get this show going. We're going to be talking about extraterrestrial intelligence. I keep wanting to identify it as alien life, and I don't know if that's the proper way to phrase the show today or not. Our guest, Professor Ed Murphy. He's an astronomy professor at UVA, also worked on NASA's Far Ultraviolet Spectroscopic Explorer. And also works on public night at the McCormick Observatory. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm quite well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
On a beautiful yet chilly Sunday.
It is.
And Rusty also pointed out that there's, what is it? Too much wind. Careful of the wind and the fire that might come from that.
Red flag warning.
Rusty Simpre always having the answers. So, are we alone? Extraterrestrial intelligence. You gave a similar speech to what our conversation will be back in September at Alumni Hall. But let's not assume that all of our listeners went to Alumni Hall for that. So, are we alone? Extraterrestrial intelligence. So, Professor, what percentage of people believe in extraterrestrial life?
You know, it's an excellent question, and polls have been done about the number of people that believe in UFOs and the number of people that believe in extraterrestrial life, and traditionally the numbers, a quite high percentage of the American population believe that we're being visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence.
So the conversation then becomes, is it split, that when you talk about the topic that you are only speaking to this percentage of the group, if you phrase the conversation one way, and the other sort of turn off?
No, because I think everyone's interested in the question, whether you believe we're being visited or not, or whether you believe that there's life out there and they're not visiting us. I think everyone has this question that we'd all like to know where life on Earth came from. How did life on Earth here arise? And did it ever arise anywhere else in the universe? Are we really the only planet in the galaxy where life arose? Or is it quite common out there?
All right. So let's jump in and talk about that. The percentage who believe we are alone versus those who believe we are not alone. But the conversation can experience. One more time, what was the percentage breakdown?
You know, I don't remember the exact percentages off the top of my head, but I know it's a majority of Americans believe that we've been visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence.
Believe not just that there are that there is the possibility, but believe we've actually been visited.
Yes.
So then there's the people who believe. So can we break it down into four sets? Those who believe there is no extraterrestrial intelligence, some that believe there is, but haven't come visit us, et cetera?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there are some people who believe that life, the way that life arose on Earth was such a small chance that it's not likely to arise elsewhere in the galaxy. Then there are those that believe that life is common in the galaxy, just not intelligent life. There are those that believe that intelligent life is common, that they're not visiting us. And then there's that fraction of people who believe that there is intelligent life in the universe, and they're visiting us. So that sort of breaks down in those four categories.
What qualifies as intelligent life?
Well, that's an excellent question because, in my opinion, a species doesn't become an intelligent species until they develop something called radio astronomy, the ability to communicate between the stars with giant radio telescopes. And the reason they're not intelligent until that point is imagine the world as it was around the year 1900. We had amazing technology back then. We were just seeing automobiles coming around. The airplane was a short distance away in time. But in 1900, with that, what we would consider an intelligent civilization on Earth, they had no ability to communicate between the stars. They had no ability to communicate with a civilization that was many light years away. It wasn't until we developed radio astronomy which really happened in the 1930s, but the big radio telescopes didn't come along until after World War II. It wasn't until that time that we were interesting in the sense that we could communicate with other civilizations far away. So my personal definition of an intelligent species is one that develops radio astronomy.
And comparative to other astronomers, because it seems to me that when we hear about intelligent life in terms of those of us who envision NASA going to Mars, or when we send out the Hubble telescope, I think for many people that intelligent life is a little less scientific than what you've talked about. For many, intelligent life would be somebody who can stand up and start a fire.
That's right. Exactly. And the thing is, you could have civilizations out there. There could be millions of planets in our galaxy that have civilizations that are where we were 100 years ago without radio telescopes. And we have no ability to detect them. We have no way to know whether they're out there or not. We have no way to communicate with them because they don't have the ability to send radio waves over long distances. And so there could be many civilizations like that out there, but they're just not, we just can't contact them.
And in terms of the definition of intelligent life, and yours being radio communication, how do we stand with that in comparison to other astronomers or others in the field? Is that sort of the general definition?
I think, you know, people in astronomy, they will recognize the fact that we need that ability to communicate in order to know whether those civilizations are out there or not. So although it may be interesting to speculate about millions of civilizations in the galaxy that are, you know, stuck where we were 100 years ago or 400 years ago, we just can't know about them. And that's one of the key pieces of science is you need evidence for something. And in order to believe that there are extraterrestrial civilizations out there, we need some kind of evidence. And that evidence will either come through the fact that they're visiting us or that they send us a signal that we can receive. And that signal is likely to come through radio waves.
This is WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call talking about extraterrestrial intelligence. Our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Astronomy Department. You are listening to 91.9 and Harrisonburg 95.1. So, Professor, we're talking about radio waves. We're talking about the definition of extraterrestrial intelligence. When you get up and start speaking about this, are you finding that the conversation changes someone's mind, or that they listen because you're confirming, or turning away because, you know, oh, that guy, he's, you know, he's the same guy who says, you know, that the you know, there's no global warming.
Right. You know, I think it always depends on the individual who's listening. There is something that we do have to be very careful about in our everyday lives called confirmation bias, where we look at the evidence and we use the evidence to try and confirm those beliefs that we already have. I think UFOs are an excellent example of this. There are many people who believe in UFOs, and when they see something on the evening news, that will reinforce it. There are others who do not believe in UFOs, and they see that same news story on the evening news, and it reinforces their belief that they do not exist. And so we have to be really careful about the evidence and considering it carefully. So my own personal belief on UFOs, because it's you know, probably the thing that most people think about when we think about extraterrestrial intelligence, is that there is, in this modern day and age, an amazing lack of evidence for us being visited by UFOs. The examples that I like to give is most of your listeners, I'm carrying a camera with me right now. Most of your listeners are probably carrying a camera with them in their phones. And it's really quite remarkable that we don't have better pictures of UFOs. We have these pictures that were taken in the 1950s of these things that look like hubcaps hovering in trees and hovering over someone's house. We really haven't seen pictures of like that since the 1950s and 60s. Nowadays, it's mostly just blurry lights in the sky. And when we do get a picture of what appears to be an alien spacecraft, they almost always turn out to be hoaxes. What we really need, the true evidence comes along when we have not just one person photographing it, but we have dozens of people photographing it from many different points of view. I think The best example of this is what happened on February 15th of this year. There was a large meteor that entered over Chelyabinsk, Russia, and it was photographed by hundreds of people from many different points of view. It was witnessed by thousands of people. If something real happens in the sky, if some spaceship really comes to visit us, I would expect us to be able to get more than one blurry photograph of it from a single individual. It should be photographed by dozens of people.
And I heard you speak, and you were talking about an event that happened in Chicago of earlier. I don't know if it was earlier this year, but somewhat recently, where a dozen or handful of people had their experience that they believed was a UFO. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was November of 2006, and it was about a dozen employees of United Airlines at Chicago O'Hare's International Airport. And they looked up in the sky, and they saw something mysterious in the sky. It was circular, and they saw it for a few seconds, and it ascended very quickly into the clouds. Now, these are a bunch of very respectable people. There were baggage handlers, ramp workers, flight attendants, a pilot was in the mix. And so in some cases, for example, the pilot, this is somebody who people trust with their lives every day. So these are reliable people, and they saw something interesting in the sky. They believe it was a UFO. My problem with that is they were at the world's second busiest airport on a busy November afternoon. You would think that when something happens in the sky that more than 12 people would see it. And more importantly, because there must have been tens of thousands of people at the airport at that time, there were probably thousands of people outside at the airport at that time. Somebody should have gotten a picture of this. It should have been noticed by more than 12 people. And this is very, very common with UFO reports like this, where you'll have one or two people who see something that they don't understand, and they talk to their coworkers or their friends and their relatives, and they convince them that what they saw was a UFO. And those people are convinced that they saw the same thing. But it often happens in small groups like this. For me as a scientist to believe that they actually saw a UFO hovering over O'Hare Airport, it would require photographs of it. And there were thousands of people out there on that day that all were carrying cameras with them. Not one of them noticed it, let alone taking a picture of it.
My memory is that you had mentioned a possible cloud type. I can't remember what it was, but I'm listening to you and I'm typing it into Google and it brings up the images of that. And I'm like, oh, you're right. It looks just like many photos we've seen of UFOs.
That's right. There's a particular type of cloud called a lenticular cloud. Lenticular comes from the old name for lens, because they're lens-shaped clouds. And they look like the sort of traditional picture of a UFO, this round, hubcap-shaped object up there in the sky. That may be what they saw. I don't know what they saw on that day, but for me to believe that it was an alien spacecraft hovering over O'Hare Airport, I need a lot more evidence than just 12 people and no photographs, especially, as I said, on a day when there were thousands of people outside.
11:12 here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm Rick Moore with our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Astronomy Department. Also helps, do you officially run the public night at McCormick Observatory?
I do, yes. I'm in charge of the education outreach program in the Astronomy Department, and so I head up the public night program at McCormick Observatory.
What happens there?
So public nights are held on the first and third Fridays of every month throughout the year. Right now they're running from 7 till 9 p.m., and they'll be running in that until March when we go back to daylight saving time, and then they'll switch to later in the day. But right now, 7 to 9 p.m., first and third Fridays of every month. If it's clear, we use the big telescope to look at an object in the sky. We have a couple smaller telescopes that you get to look through as well. One of our faculty members is giving a presentation either on their research or something interesting going on in astronomy right now. We have some exhibits. We talk about the history of the telescope. So there's lots of things to do up there. You don't have to show up right at 7. You can come a little bit later in the evening and just stay as long as you'd like.
Have you ever had somebody during public night say, oh, I saw a UFO?
Oh, I've had lots of people ask me about something that they saw in the sky during their lifetime. Not during public night itself, but I've had lots of people come up to me and say, I saw something 10 years ago. Do you know what it was? I saw something when I was a kid. And in many cases, I can't explain what they saw for a couple of reasons. I wasn't there and I didn't see it myself. They didn't take pictures of it in many cases because it was so long ago. But in almost all these cases, they saw it by themselves. There weren't other witnesses to it. And even if they did see something, we can't leap to the conclusion that it's an extraterrestrial intelligence. As an astronomer, having spent many thousands upon thousands of hours staring at the night sky, I have to say that there could be dozens of things, probably hundreds of things it could be before we would even consider it being an extraterrestrial vehicle visiting us.
Well, now that you bring that up, I hadn't thought about this in preparation for today's show, but let me share with you my experience of that type, where I'm approximately, I'll say I'm 10 years old, I'm outside of my grandparents' house, a suburban area. I'm laying in the driveway, and I see what I thought at first was a star, but it's moving, and it moves, I have no idea, you know, how far that is, but it moves a noticeable distance from point A to point B, and then it pauses and then turns around and goes in the opposite direction. And I thought to myself, well, a plane can't do that. What could that possibly be? A meteor couldn't do that. So let me ask the astronomy professor while I have him with me.
You know, I don't know what it was. I wish I could tell you it. Since I wasn't there and I didn't see it, I will say this, that we get a lot of people who call into the astronomy department and they ask us, especially with what's going on in the night sky right now, they'll tell us that they saw this really bright light in the western sky and that it's moving around very rapidly and it's changing colors and they want to know what it is. They believe it's hovering over their neighbor's house. And I'll point out to them that the bright planet Venus is visible in the western sky right now. If you go out just after sunset, you'll see brilliant, beautiful Venus hanging up there in the sky. A surprising number of people confuse Venus with a UFO. And what I find most interesting about their details is when they talk to me about it, they'll tell me about how it was moving around. Now, Venus is a planet. It doesn't do that. But they've convinced themselves that it does because they're not thinking of a planet. They're not thinking of something millions of miles away that's sitting still. They're thinking it's a UFO. And in their minds, a UFO should be moving around. So they'll often tell me that it's moving around. And the usual clincher to this is when they're convinced that it can't possibly be Venus, I'll say, well, where was it with respect to Venus? Because Venus is by far the brightest thing in the western sky right now. And they'll say, well, I don't remember seeing Venus. And the thing is, if you saw a bright light in the western sky, it was almost certainly Venus. So I don't know what yours was that went and stopped and turned around and came back.
It was a UFO with extraterrestrial intelligence
on
it.
And I would say, you know, again, that's way down on the list of possibilities.
I didn't have an iPhone at the time. I couldn't take a picture. 11:17 here on the Wake Up Call with Professor Ed Murphy as we talk about extraterrestrial intelligence. And are we alone? All right, back with Professor Ed Murphy as we talk about this. Professor, so let's talk for a minute about the Drake equation.
So the Drake equation is an attempt to estimate the number of intelligent communicating civilizations that might be out there in the galaxy. And so very briefly, we live in a galaxy that contains about 200 billion stars. And the Drake equation begins by saying, now, some fraction of those are stars like our sun that could support life around them. Some stars are really hot. They're not likely to have life around them because their lifetimes are just too short for life to develop. Some stars are much smaller than our sun, and they're probably too cool to have life around them. So some fraction of the stars are stars like our sun. And a good estimate for that, a good rough estimate, is about 1 in 10 stars. So if our Milky Way galaxy has 200 billion stars, and 1 in 10 of those is like our sun, that means there's about 20 billion sun-like stars out there. Now imagine that 1 out of every 10 of those stars has planets around it. That would be 2 billion sun-like stars with planets going around them. Now imagine that 1 out of every 10 of those had an Earth-like planet. So that means there are 200 million Earth-like planets going around sun-like stars out there. Now imagine that 1 out of every 10 of those developed some kind of life. There'd be 20 million Earth-like planets with life on them around sun-like stars. And imagine 1 out of every 10 of those developed intelligent life at some point. That means that there'd be 2 million intelligent civilizations out there in the galaxy. The basics of the Drake equation are to try and take the number of stars in the galaxy and figure out how many intelligent civilizations are out there. The thing is, some of the numbers in the Drake equation, some of the fractions, are not well known at all. For example, the number of planets that that are Earth-like is not terribly well known. We're getting a better handle on that thanks to some new NASA missions like Kepler, but or at least Earth-sized planets. How many of those will develop life is a number that we just don't know. An optimist would say that every Earth-like planet, if it has liquid water, it will eventually develop life. And a pessimist might say that the conditions under which life formed on Earth were unique or happened so seldomly that life may not form. And so the problem with the Drake equation is, depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, you can get either a large number, say 2 million civilizations in the galaxy, or you can get a very low number, that we are essentially the only intelligent civilization in the galaxy.
Would the Drake equation and the numbers that are derived from it have also play a role, or have your religious beliefs also play a role in it? Because did God create the entire galaxy, the universe, and so therefore there is just the one Earth? Are there, I want to know how someone who has religious faith is also an astronomist. And I don't know what your religious faith is, if any, but I would think that of some astronomists have a religious belief and attend church on a regular basis and pray to God in their evenings. So talk about that for a moment.
Sure. So there are certainly some astronomers who are religious and believe in a personal God. The thing about astronomy, about science in general, is that we have to be very careful to separate science from religion. And the reason that we have to do this is, I think Stephen Jay Gould, the evolutionary biologist, put it best, is that they are separate magisterium. They answer different questions. Science is looking for natural explanations to natural phenomena. And we can't rely on supernatural explanations in science, because supernatural explanations don't lead to any new insight in the universe. A classic example, if you go back thousands of years, is wondering, why does the sun rise and set? Well, it could be the Apollo god, the sun god Apollo, riding his chariot through the sky. That's one possible explanation. That's a supernatural explanation. It's not a natural explanation. And because it's supernatural, you're expected to just leave it at that, and that's the answer to it. And of course, as a scientist, we want a natural explanation. Why does the sun rise and set? So we continue looking into it, and we find out that the Earth rotates and the Earth revolves around the sun. So in science, we have to be very careful not to rely on supernatural explanations. That said, there are many scientists who are religious, and they just have to divide those two magisteria. They have to divide science on the one hand, which demands evidence and it demands proof. And on the other side, you have religion, which is all about faith. You can't prove anything in religion. And they have to keep those two sides separate because, as I said, in science, we can't rely on supernatural explanations.
Professor Ed Murphy with us here on WNRN.
Boonesboro Shopping Center, Lynchburg shopping destination with shops like Loft, Francesca's, Joseph A. Bank, Chico's, and Talbot's, plus local boutiques and fine dining. It's Boonesboro Shopping Center for gifts and your grocery list. You can find Boonesboro Shopping Center on Facebook for weekly specials and events.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And again, our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy, as we talk about extraterrestrial intelligence. He's a UVA professor of astronomy. Professor, so we're talking about the Drake equation and sort of, if you have X number of stars, then you should have X number of planets, then you should have X number that might have life. Do mathematicians ever get involved in the Drake equation and say, yes, there must be, or no, there cannot be? That's an invalid equation to use?
The math is really quite simple, so we don't need mathematicians involved because it's just fractions. But there is a lot of debate about the various fractions and as to whether, for example, is it common for life to develop on a planet with water, or is it quite uncommon? I think the Drake equation is more valuable not in telling us how many intelligent civilizations might be out there, but as a way to organize our search for that extraterrestrial intelligence. For example, we know that, or we believe, because based on the life that we have here on Earth, that we need a sun-like star. So we have to find the number of sun-like stars in the galaxy. We also believe that liquid water is absolutely essential to the development of life, and so we have to find Earth-like planets that have liquid water on the surface. So the Drake equation is better at helping us organize our search than it is right now at telling us how many intelligent civilizations are out there. Because the biggest number, the biggest uncertainty in the Drake equation is the very last term. And that term is how long does an intelligent civilization last? That is, once you've developed, in my definition of an intelligent civilization, once you've developed radio astronomy and you've developed this technology to communicate amongst the stars, does your civilization last for 50 years, 100 years, 10,000 years, or a million years? And that makes a big difference, because if they only last for 50 years, if they develop the technology to have radio astronomy, but they somehow manage to kill themselves off, whether it's through nuclear war or global warming or biological warfare, if they only exist for 50 years, the odds of us contacting them are extraordinarily small, that we would happen to be listening in the precise 50-year window that they happen to be around, and vice versa. Now, if they last for a million years, then the odds of contact are much better. And that's one of the terms in the Drake equation, and it's by far the one that is least well known.
So talk to us a bit about the size of the universe. I found that to be almost overwhelming. And I recognize that there's no visual graphics for people to use during this. But talk to us about the size of the universe. You talked about the length of time for a radio wave to pass from point A to point B, and the length of time for intelligent life to live.
Yeah, so in astronomy, we traditionally use different units of measure for measuring how far things are away from us, because the mile and the kilometer are no longer sufficient. So one of the units that we use in astronomy is the light year. It's the distance that light travels in 1 year. Now, light travels 186,000 miles every second. So a light year is simply you take 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 365 and a quarter days in a year, light traveling 186,000 miles for every one of those seconds, and you add it up. And so a light year is about 6 trillion miles. It's how far light travels in 1 year. To give you an idea of how far that is, in our some nearby things, the moon is about 1.25 light seconds away from us. So when you go out and you see the moon in the sky, you're seeing the moon not as it looked now, but as it looked about 1.25 seconds ago when that light left. Now, the moon doesn't change much in 1.25 seconds, but you can hear that in the old Apollo tapes of the astronauts on the surface of the moon when they were asked a simple question, did you put the sample in the bag? It takes 1.25 seconds for those radio waves, which travel at the speed of light, to get all the way out to the moon. Then the astronaut answers the question and takes 1.25 seconds for that answer to come back. The round trip delay in there is 2.5 seconds, and that's an awkward way to hold a conversation when you ask a question and somebody waits 2.5 seconds before they answer your question. And in that case, it just came from the time it took the radio waves to travel to the moon and back. Today's a beautiful sunny day out there. As you go outside and feel the sunlight on your face, keep in mind that the light you're feeling left the sun 8 minutes and 20 seconds ago. The light travel time from the sun is 8 minutes, 20 seconds. So again, the sun doesn't change much in 8 minutes, 20 seconds, but that's how long it takes the light to get here. The rovers on Mars are a beautiful example of this. School children often ask when I'm giving a tour up at the observatory and I talk about the rovers on Mars, is there some engineer at the Jet Propulsion Lab in California who has an Xbox controller or driving the rover on Mars? And the answer is no, because the signal from Mars, when Mars is at its furthest away from us, can take 20 minutes to get to Earth. And then they tell the rover to turn. They use the controller to tell the rover to turn. It'll take 20 minutes for that signal to go back. So if they were to suddenly see a rock appear in front of the rover and they told the rover to turn, first of all, that picture is already 20 minutes old. And when they tell the rover to turn to miss the rock, it's going to take 20 minutes for that signal to get out there. So the rovers have to be smart enough to drive themselves. We can't do it because of the light travel time. Now, our solar system, the most distant body in our solar system that most people think about is Pluto. And Pluto is 5.5 light hours away from us. It takes light from Pluto 5.5 hours to get here. The most distant spacecraft that humans have ever sent out is Voyager 1. Voyager 1 was launched in September of 1977, so it's been in space for 36 years now. We're still in contact with it. We still communicate with it regularly. But Voyager 1 is more than three times farther from the sun than Pluto is. The light travel time out to Voyager 1 right now is 18 hours. That is, it takes light, radio waves from Voyager 1, 18 hours to get to Earth. And so when we send a signal out to Voyager 1, it takes 18 hours for the signal to get out there. Voyager 1 hears our signal and immediately responds, "I've heard your signal." It sends its response back. It takes another 18 hours for that response to come back. The round trip time is 36 hours to hear from Voyager 1. So that's a day and a half. And that's the most distant spacecraft we have. The nearest star, by comparison, it's called Alpha Centauri. It's only visible in the southern hemisphere. Alpha Centauri is 4.4 light years away from us. So the furthest spacecraft we have is 18 hours away. The nearest star is 4.4 years away at the speed of light. And that's just the nearest star. The average star you see in the night sky is many tens or hundreds of years away. And our galaxy as a whole is 100,000 light years across. So it takes light 100,000 years to go from one side of the galaxy to the other. And then out there in the universe as a whole, we know of billions of galaxies, and the most distant galaxies are about 13 billion light years away from us.
Professor Ed Murphy here on WNRN 1131. We're talking about extraterrestrial intelligence. Professor, so now that we've, have this sort of difficult image in my head, 18 million light years away, but we're talking about, are we alone? So how would any communication work or not work because of this distance between Earth and any possible other planet with human intelligence?
It's an excellent question, and the best answer I can give is that it may be, if we ever discover an extraterrestrial intelligence out there, that the people who hear the question will not be the ones to receive the answer. Imagine that we discover a civilization that's 1,000 light years away from us, and we receive a transmission from them. That transmission is 1,000 years old, and when we formulate a response and send it back out, the people on that planet who receive our response will not be the same people who sent that signal, if that civilization even exists anymore, if they're even still listening out there. So interstellar communication will be extraordinarily difficult unless they happen to be immediately next to us in the universe, unless they happen to be one of the nearby stars where the light travel time might be 5 or 10 or even 20 years. I think for most of them, where the light travel time could be hundreds or thousands of years, it'll be a very different way of communicating.
Are we somewhat, are we using egocentric science in any manner where everything is done around human belief? You talked about the fact that many people, sort of the science is based on the fact that you need to be X distance away from the sun. You have to have water, a water body, because that's where life comes from.
Yes. So, in fact, that bit of science is very egocentric, I guess is the word that you used. It's very centered around carbon-based life. And the reason for that is it's the only kind of life that we know about in the universe. And there could be, Star Trek was a good example of this. There could be silicon-based life out there. In fact, some people have argued there may be silicon-based life here on Earth. You could imagine that the concrete in your walls have some kind of silicon-based life form. Its metabolism is so slow that it takes millions of years to breathe in and breathe out, and we would never know that it existed here. There are many things you can think of in science fiction, lots of different life forms, lots of different structures, lots of different chemistries for creating life. But in science, we can speculate about those things, but if we're actually going to go out and conduct a search, we have to search for what we know could exist. And the one thing that we know could exist out there is carbon-based life that relies on water. So, as you said, there may be a silicon-based life form that lives perfectly happily at 1,000 degrees out there, but we don't have it here, so we don't know how to search for it. We don't know what to look for. I like to comment to students sometimes that, think about Mars for a second. We have rovers on Mars. There's no evidence for organic life on Mars. In 1976, we landed two landers on the surface that searched for organic materials in the soil. And the, in my opinion, the solution to that was negative. They did not find any good evidence for organic life. We've seen no evidence of macroscopic life on Mars. Now, does that mean that there can't be life on Mars? Well, if the rover saw something get up and crawl across the surface and sit back down again, we'd know there was life on Mars, even if it wasn't carbon-based. But other than that, we have no idea how to look for it. If there's a silicon-based life form out there that lives at 1,000 degrees and it doesn't communicate with radio waves and doesn't build spaceships, I have no idea how to communicate with it, so I don't even know how to search for it.
11:35 here on the Wake Up Call with Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Astronomy Department, talking about extraterrestrial intelligence.
Stinson Vineyards, whose tasting room is open Thursday through Sunday at 4744 Sugar Hollow Road in Whitehall. You're invited to taste their wines and learn about their wine club. You can also find Stinson Vineyards wines at grocery stores and wine shops all over Virginia. More information at StinsonVineyards.com under Where to Buy.
Music Today. Based in Crozet, Music Today powers ticketing for local venues such as the Intellis Wireless Pavilion, the Southern Cafe and Music Hall, and the Jefferson Theater, and is official web stores for hundreds of artists, athletes, and entertainers. That's Music Today.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today as we talk about extraterrestrial intelligence. We did get a call in. Let me see if I can, somebody didn't want to come on the air. So, Professor, let's see. Is it possible that we don't have the scientific knowledge to explain these past phenomenons and that they do exist? Or does science say that it doesn't exist until we can explain it?
No, science, it can certainly exist without an explanation. What I'm worried about, especially when it comes to UFOs, is the lack of evidence. It's not a lack of explanation, but a lack of evidence. As I said, what we really need to prove if people believe in UFOs is photographs of a spaceship hovering in the sky. You know, a dozen photographs taken from different points of view, very much like the Chelyabinsk meteorite last February. So it's not a lack of explanation, but instead a lack of evidence. And I think an interesting aside to this is that it is my hope that the wide availability of digital cameras, the fact that so many people have them now, should finally start to put to rest some of these things that have been floating around, ideas like UFOs, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster. Now that everybody has a digital camera, if anybody sees anything interesting going on, they'll photograph it. And if it's a real phenomenon hovering over a U.S. city, it will be photographed by dozens of people. A really neat example of this was in Utah, Salt Lake City. In 2007, there was this long, silver, cigar-shaped object hovering in the sky, and it was reported to the police by different people. It was photographed by different people. It was clearly something real in the sky. Now, we know exactly what it was. It was actually an amateur blimp maker who had let a blimp get away from him. But what's really interesting is you go back and you listen to the eyewitness reports, and one of them reported that it was bigger than a football field and it was hovering in the sky. Well, in fact, the blimp was only about 30 feet long. But eyewitnesses, as we know both from science and from even court testimony, eyewitnesses don't always get things correct because they're taken up by the emotion of the moment. They're caught up in something they weren't expecting. So we have to be careful with eyewitness testimony, but those photographs prove that people saw something in Salt Lake City. And as I said, we know exactly what it was because the blimp maker finally came forward and said that it was his blimp.
We talked about the Drake equation, but when we start talking about extraterrestrial intelligence, the Fermi paradox seems to come into play here. Explain that to us.
So the Fermi paradox is this idea that I had mentioned early on, that if there are 200 billion stars in the galaxy and 20 billion sun-like stars and 2 billion of them have planets and 200 million have Earth-like planets and 20 million have life and 2 million have intelligent life, it seems that there are just so many stars in the galaxy that there has to be intelligent life out there. And the Fermi paradox was first thought of, or at least in its modern version, it was first thought of by the famous physicist Enrico Fermi. And in the spring of 1950, he was working at Los Alamos Lab, and they were discussing some interesting UFO sightings in the sky and some other things going on. And they were talking about the possibility of faster than light travel. Would it ever be possible to travel faster than the speed of light? And they were sitting at lunch, and Enrico Fermi looks at everyone else, and he suddenly says, "Where is everybody?" And they immediately understood what he meant was that he had done some calculations to show that if intelligent life was common in the galaxy and they could travel at even a small fraction of the speed of light, some intelligent civilizations should have visited us long ago and many times over. A good example of this is the age of the galaxy. Our galaxy is 13.7 billion years old, so roughly about 13 billion years old is the age of our galaxy. That's a long, long time. Our sun will live for 10 billion years. It's only about 4.5 billion years old now. So our galaxy is three times older than our sun and solar system. There has been an awful lot of time in the history of the galaxy for an intelligent civilization to come visit Earth. Yet we have no good evidence that they're visiting us now. We have no good evidence that they have visited us in the past. And so if the universe really is teeming with intelligent life, where are they? Why haven't they come visit us? And so that's another way that people use to organize their thoughts on this question of extraterrestrial intelligence, is that maybe we can look for the reasons why they're not out there. And the solutions usually fall into three categories. The first category is that they really do exist out there. The second category is that they exist, but they're not traveling here. And then the last category is that they don't exist at all. And so you can consider each of those classes of solutions.
I'm researching my homework for today's show, and part of it is that the first one you mentioned is that there are extraterrestrials out there.
Uh-huh.
And I ran across the zoo hypothesis.
So the zoo hypothesis is a fascinating idea that maybe they exist out there and they're interested in us, and so they have cordoned us off like animals in a zoo, and they're intentionally not making contact with us, and they're intentionally hiding themselves from us so that they can study us. Now, it's called the zoo hypothesis because it's, and I think even hypothesis is a bit too strong of a term, because a hypothesis is testable. You can carry out some kind of way to test it. In its strongest version, the zoo hypothesis states that the intelligence civilization that's watching us is so good that they have the technology never to be detected. That is, we can't detect them. In my opinion, if we can't detect them, then it's not scientific. There's no way to prove this correct or incorrect. It's actually very much, in that case, like a supernatural explanation rather than a natural explanation. There's lots of problems with the zoo hypothesis. For those people who are familiar with science fiction, Star Trek had this. It was the prime directive. It said that when you reach a less advanced civilization, that you're not to interfere with them. Maybe they have their own prime directive out there, and we are a less advanced civilization, and they're leaving us alone. But the problem is that didn't work so well in Star Trek. Almost every time somebody brought up the prime directive, they immediately turned around and violated it.
I had Professor Paul Cantor on at the end of August, his book on pop culture, and that was one of the key conversations, was about the prime directive on Star Trek. By the way, you can always go to cvillepodcast.com and pull up Paul Cantor's visit here. So again, our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Department of Astronomy. We're talking about extraterrestrial intelligence. Are we alone? 11:43 here on the Wake Up Call. So, Professor, could we be the first group, or could we be the last group of extraterrestrial intelligence?
You know, it is possible that we are the first intelligent species in the galaxy. That is one of the solutions to the Fermi paradox, is that if the development of life is extraordinarily rare, or even if life is common, but the development of intelligent life is a rare phenomenon, it may be that we are the very first intelligent species in the galaxy. That's certainly a possibility, that we're first. As for the question as to whether we're last, it may be another way to think about that one is the idea I had raised earlier, that maybe intelligent civilizations don't last very long. maybe intelligent civilizations are popping up in the galaxy all the time, but they only last for 50 or 100 or a few hundred years before they inevitably kill themselves off, whether it's through nuclear war or biological warfare or global warming or something else, that each and every one of these intelligent species inevitably dooms themselves. Because in order to have the ability to have radio astronomy, to be interesting enough to communicate amongst the stars, they also have probably developed the technology to destroy themselves at the same time.
Talk about your calendar. I remember you talking about how we in today's society are actually like at 11:59 p.m. on December 31st.
Yeah,
talk about that.
Yeah, I mentioned that the galaxy, that the universe was 13.7 billion years old, and our galaxy was 13 billion years old. And it's really hard to put that in perspective because those numbers are just so big. So the calendar, I believe Carl Sagan was the first one to come up with the universal calendar or the cosmic calendar, which says, let's cram it into a period of time that people can really understand, which is a year, a regular human year. So imagine that the universe begins on January 1st at midnight. That's when the Big Bang happens. And then December 31st at midnight, the end of the year, is right now. So we can work out what happens in that calendar year. So the Big Bang happens on January 1st. Our Milky Way galaxy forms and is finished forming in February sometime. The galaxy, for the most part, has come together by early February, and it's finished forming by late February. We go into March, April, May, June, July, August. All that time, stars are being born, living out their lives, and dying. A typical star will live from a few million to billions of years, and so in those times, in those months, lots and lots of stars are being born, living out their lives, and dying, and being born, living out their lives, and dying. Our sun and the Earth don't come along in the calendar until September, early September. So the Earth arrives and the sun in early September in the cosmic calendar. So you can see we're fairly late in the year. Now, that's not humans. That's when the Earth was born. In late September, we have first evidence for life on Earth. And by early October on that calendar, we have evidence for fossil life on Earth. So I think a really interesting aspect of Earth is that the Earth forms in early September. By late September or early October at the latest, we've already got life on Earth. Life on Earth formed very, very quickly after the conditions on the planet had settled down. And I think that's a really interesting point to make about the formation of life, is that simple life, anyhow, seems to start up very quickly. In the one case that we have, Earth here, simple life started very quickly on the Earth. But what's also interesting is that simple life hangs on for a very long time. We have simple life in early October, all the way through November, all the way into December. We don't get complicated life on Earth, animals, until early December. So for the first few billion years of the history of the Earth was populated by nothing but single-celled and very simple organisms. It's not until early December on this cosmic calendar that we get complex life like animals. The dinosaurs arrive on December 17th or so, mid-December, and they hang around for a couple days. And they're finally gone by about the day after Christmas, by about December 26th. So the dinosaurs hang on, but the dinosaurs go extinct on December 26th. And humans, modern humans, don't arrive until a few minutes before midnight. And all of recorded civilization, the last 400 years, since the time of Copernicus, when he discovered that the Earth is going around the sun and not vice versa, that happened in the last second before midnight. So 400 years of time corresponds to about 1 second on that cosmic calendar.
I find that to be so fascinating and still difficult to get to grasp mentally. Our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA, talking about an extraterrestrial intelligence. Professor, we had a listener ask, what about crop circles? Because doesn't that explain that there must be at least an extraterrestrial life that is capable of travel?
No, not at all. In fact, crop circles, I think, have been quite convincingly shown to be hoaxes. And so there's a pair of individuals in Great Britain who started the crop circle phenomenon. And I think it's been clearly and convincingly shown that all crop circles can be easily explained by a couple people with a board connected to a piece of wood going out and stomping these grains down in the form of circles. But even if we don't know that they're hoaxed, there's no reason to believe that we're being visited by an extraterrestrial civilization. There could be other explanations as well, but that is definitely not the sort of concrete evidence we need. But I think there's overwhelming evidence that crop circles are simply hoaxes.
What about pyramids? What about Stonehenge, Easter Island?
Yeah, the Nazca lines down in South America. I think in all of those cases, we don't give credit to our ancestors. There's not much evidence that human intelligence has evolved significantly since early times. Those people were every bit as smart as we were. And in fact, when you think about it, we had our Einstein. They had their Einsteins as well. They had people who were every bit as smart as Albert Einstein was. They didn't have as much background knowledge as Einstein did. They don't have as much background knowledge as we do. But those people were every bit as smart. So it's not surprising to me that they were able to figure out how to build the pyramids or how to build Stonehenge or how to build the Nazca Lines or Easter Island. I think we do a great disservice to our ancestors when we say that, well, they weren't smart enough to do this, so clearly UFOs had to be involved. Just because we don't know how they did it doesn't mean it was beyond human intelligence at the time to carry it out. And the pyramids are a beautiful example. There are lots of ideas on how they may have built the pyramids. We don't know the details of how they built the pyramids, but in looking at them and looking at the possible explanations, I don't see that any of it is outside the realm of what dedicated, smart humans could do. Because, as I said, they were just every bit as smart as we are.
11:50 here on the Wake Up Call with our guests, Professor Ed Murphy.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio.
We want to thank the folks who help us get our iPhone or Android user app up and running. It's easy to get your WNRN on your phone. For Android users, we recommend the TuneIn app, which is available at Google Play. WillowTree Apps has created the WNRN iPhone app, which you can find at the App Store or at WNRN.org. Just click on Listen to download the app. All right, back with our guest, Professor Murphy from UVA. So, Professor, I want to talk about, has NASA funding had any effect on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Yes, it has, but there's a NASA had for a long time been interested in the question of extraterrestrial intelligence. And interestingly, they weren't as interested in the science aspect of it as they were the technology aspect of it. One of the ideas is that an extraterrestrial civilization may be trying to communicate with us through radio waves. The problem is there are billions of potential channels that they could try and communicate on. And NASA was trying to figure out the technology side of how do you search billions of channels for a very weak signal. This had lots of interesting implications for communications. So NASA for a long time had funded a search or the beginning of a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But in one of their episodes of cost cutting, Congress looked at this and Congress felt that spending funding on searching for extraterrestrial intelligence wasn't a good use of taxpayer dollars. So they cut the NASA effort. And I think that was short-sighted, not because of the lack of searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, but because of the technology aspects. NASA had some really interesting signal processing and technology things that they wanted to do with that funding that were the primary driver, in my opinion, from NASA's point of view. But in any case, the funding was cut, NASA got out of that game, and they have not since then been searching for extraterrestrial life. Once the federal funding for it was cut, it fell to the private sector, and a group called Project Phoenix and the SETI Institute. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They formed a private institute in California to carry on this search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and they've been doing it by raising funding. They have now built their own telescope called the Allen Telescope Array. It's named for Paul Allen, one of the founders of Microsoft, who donated a lot of money to get this array up and running. And they're using that to do a private search for extraterrestrial transmissions. But there is no concerted effort through any of the federal agencies to do a search for extraterrestrial communication today.
Do you think that we are more likely to? So let's assume that there is extraterrestrial intelligence out there, and they meet your deadline or your guided definition of able to communicate. Would we be more likely to have contact through communication, radio waves, or through travel? Because what I heard you say earlier is that, maybe not here, maybe on the podcast that I heard earlier, is that the communication would be hard to find because of having your radio tuned to the right channel at the right time of day and the length of time it takes for the communication to travel through the universe. So which method do you think we're more likely to make contact?
Oh, I think the problem there is that for those that believe that we're not alone out there in the universe, both travel and communication are exceptionally difficult. So think about travel for a second. I mentioned that the nearest star is 4.4 light years away. Voyager 1, that most distant spacecraft we have out there, also happens to be one of our fastest spacecraft. And at the rate that Voyager 1 is traveling right now, it's going to take about 70,000 years to get to the nearest star. And that's just the nearest star. Now imagine that our grandchildren build a spacecraft that can go 10 times faster. It's still going to take 7,000 years to get out there. And imagine that their grandchildren build a spacecraft that can go 10 times faster than that. So that's 100 times faster than what we can do today. It's still going to take 700 years to get just to the nearest star. Right now, our fastest spacecraft travel at 1/10,000th the speed of light. If they could go 1,000 times faster, which is 10% the speed of light, it would still take 44 years to get to the nearest star. So space travel is exceptionally difficult because the distances are so vast. And even when you're traveling at a fraction of the speed of light, a good fraction, say 1 or 10% the speed of light, the travel times are decades or hundreds of years. That makes it very difficult to imagine getting on a spaceship. Imagine getting on a spaceship to travel to the nearest star, where at 1% the speed of light, it's 440 years in a single direction. When you get on that spaceship, you know that you're not going to arrive at your destination. You know that your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren won't make it on this trip, that you're going to have a ship that's large enough that can support these people for 440 years, and it's some distant descendant of yours that's actually going to make it to the nearby star. And I just can't see civilizations doing that.
But won't we have, and I realize I'm speaking to a scientist about something that we, about sort of science fiction, but geometric progression in our abilities to build, create, and learn. I mean, from 2013, where we are now in terms of communications use is far different from where we were in 2000.
That's true.
As a society, I would believe that our geometric progression in terms of skills, inventions, et cetera, would allow us to, I don't know. I say go faster and get further, but you are already talking about doing that as grandchildren to the next two generations following.
So unfortunately, sometimes our ambitions run up against the laws of physics. And a good example of that is spaceflight. So the fastest spacecraft that we were launching in the early 1960s are the same speed that we're launching today. Our spacecraft today are no faster than they were in the 1960s. And the reason for that is we're using chemical rockets. And in the early 1960s, we had pretty much maxed out the efficiency of chemical rockets. And we have still are using chemical rockets at their maximum efficiency today. We can't go any faster using chemical rockets. If we want to go 10 times faster than we are today, we're going to have to develop a whole new technology that we don't have yet, that we're not even testing yet, to go 10 times faster than we are now. And the problem is, to travel to the nearby stars, we don't need to go 10 times faster. We need to go 1,000 times faster or 10,000 times faster than we are now.
All right, 2 minutes left on this topic, communication about extraterrestrial intelligence and are we alone? So, Professor, I saved the best for last in the last, 120 seconds. Area 51, haven't we already been visited?
No, we have not. So Area 51 is a place where the Air Force tests top secret things, top secret aircraft. But again, there's no evidence that we've ever been visited by aliens. Many people will remember the famous Fox 1995 alien autopsy video. Ray Santilli, the man who produced that, has admitted now that it's a fake, or at least that he admits that most of it's a fake, but he's lost all of his credibility, in my opinion. There's lots of reasons to believe that alien autopsy video is a fake. There's lots of evidence to believe that Roswell, New Mexico, was nothing more than a top-secret balloon test conducted by the U.S. Army at the time. And so there's just no evidence for it. And for Area 51, I believe it's just a base where they test future aircraft technologies, and they don't want anybody to know what they're testing out there. But there's no... Let me give you a good example. People often claim that we're mining these alien spacecraft for technology. Look around you. Can you find a piece of technology that clearly didn't come from this planet? Because your phone, your computer, all this wonderful technology, that all goes back to the transistor that was invented by John Bardeen back in the 1950s. You know, we know exactly where all this technology came from. There's no magic that has appeared around us.
All right. Last question real quick. Do you believe that we will ever have communications with extraterrestrial intelligence?
No, I don't think so.
All right. There you go. Our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy, UVA Professor of Astronomy. Also, public night at McCormick Observatory. What days and times?
First and third Fridays of every month, so the next one will be Friday, December 6th.
Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Fascinating conversation. Our next week, we'll be back. Please enjoy and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by The Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.